Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The world of Warcraft is a virtual world with over 11 million flesh and blood subscribers who pay monthly to roam the online continents of Azeroth as our orcs and trolls and more, killing boars and raiding enemy terrain. My guest today, a sociologist, spent over 2,000 hours gaming out the world of Warcraft. Within it, he found what may be a vision of the future of the human world. This hour On Point, tapping a virtual world to see our own. You can join the conversation. Are you a World of Warcraft player? Can we find lessons, even the future, there? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is William Sims Bainbridge, sociologist of religion, science, popular culture, and director of the Human-Centered Computing Program at the National Science Foundation. He's author of many books, including God from the Machine and Nanoconvergence. His new book out tomorrow is The Warcraft Civilization, Social Science in a Virtual World. He spent 2,300-plus hours, that's more than a year of a full-time job, immersed in the massive multiplayer online game World of Warcraft in the name of scientific research. Bill Bainbridge, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks, Tom, or I should say Loktar. That means victory in the orcish language, which we speak in the Horde. I should point out that I've actually done research in a dozen other virtual worlds, and all of my World of Warcraft research has been done on my own time, not funded by the U.S. government.
Okay, we're going to count on you to take us in here, Bill. I mean, this is completely, this is terra incognita to me. I don't know it at all. I have seen... This is years back now when Sims first came out. I've seen how you can get into one of these virtual worlds, in that case building cities and economies and so on. And, you know, you start and it's a reasonable time of the evening and you're playing with your kids and you end and they're long ago gone to bed, in my case, and it's half the night played away. I mean, they can be very, very alluring, as evidenced by the 11 million, I guess, who have signed up to join World of Warcraft. What's it look like in that world, Bill?
Well, on your screen, you see the equivalent of about 300 square miles of highly diverse terrain. You hear sounds. You can run around. You're represented by a character, and you can have multiple characters, but only one at a time. You can either look through the character's eyes as you move through this virtual environment, or, as most people do, pull back and look down on them and operate them as a kind of a puppet. In many respects, it's like On Point. You and I are in different cities, mm-hmm. and yet we're communicating just the way players on a team in World of Warcraft might. Or in May 2008, I held a major scientific conference in World of Warcraft where we had 120 scholars whose bodies were all the way from Australia through North America to Russia, and yet their avatars or characters were in one virtual location.
Now, we'd better explain how that works, Bill. I mean, you did it for a conference, but in World of Warcraft,
yes.
This is massive multiplayer online gaming, so you've got people in this 300 virtual square miles from all over the world adopting avatars or characters within the game and then interacting in real time online.
That's correct. We were in specific locations. My favorite was the sewers of Undercity, where we all sat around a green pool of liquid. But it was a serious meeting. Springer, the European Technical Publishing House, is about to publish a book of proceedings from that conference. Most people treat World of Warcraft as a game, but it's also an economy, it's also a culture, It's a major cultural artifact, a new art form.
We'll look at those aspects of what goes on there. But just to give those who may not spend time in the World of Warcraft a sense of it, here's some dialogue from this massive multiplayer online game. This is some dialogue before the final Black Temple battle in Shadowmoon Valley. Boss Illidan Stormrage is challenged here by Akama, a tribe leader and former ally.
Akama, your duplicity is hardly surprising. I should have slaughtered you and your malformed brethren long ago.
We've come to end your reign, Illidan. My people and all of Outland shall be free.
Boldly said, but I remain unconvinced.
Time has come. The moment is at hand.
You are not prepared.
And there we are in World of Warcraft with Illidan Stormrage and Akama. Okay, Bill, the headline out of your research, and we'll get into it, but the headline is that you see a vision of the human future somehow in the World of Warcraft. Help us begin to get our minds around that, Bill.
Well, first I might note that what you just played, except for the fact that they're speaking rather than singing, could have been from Wagner's Ring operas. And there's a huge cultural background to World of Warcraft that points us toward the future. In the world of Warcraft, different ethnic groups are competing for insufficient resources. Bad judgment and selfishness on the part of leaders, like those who just spoke there, have made it much more difficult for them to cooperate and to survive. But the resources are objectively limited. Mm. And so, like perhaps the nations of the future world, they're not only competing for scarce resources, but have to struggle with difficult issues of loyalty and how to build coalitions.
So as a sociologist, you look at that scenario and begin to pull on what strings, begin to learn what about human nature and maybe what about the, you know, what we call real world future.
One of the ways we do that, of course, is by looking at how people interact. And virtual worlds are an absolutely amazing resource for social scientists because we can record so much of the data one way or another see how people are cooperating in the guilds in World of Warcraft. I'm particularly interested in what was created by Chris Metzen and the other good people at Blizzard Entertainment and comparing across them. For example, Lord of the Rings Online, in which I also have an elf character.
This is another massive multiplayer online game, I guess.
Yes, it's very high quality. It's similar to and competitive with World of Warcraft. But it assumes that everybody can cooperate on the same team together against evil. Whereas in World of Warcraft, there are two factions, the Horde and the Alliance. Each of them is a coalition of different nations. And so the mythology of it raises issues that the real world will be facing over the coming decades.
So one one utility of this is a kind of, as you say, quantifiable, analyzable world. Maybe things go a little quicker here in the virtual world. But here's, I've got a comment from Edward Castronova from Indiana University. He says that you, Bainbridge, provides the best analysis to date of the way World of Warcraft and similar new media forms with their millions and millions of users are reshaping central aspects of our culture, groups, religion, economy, education, and more. That's not just playing out or sort of, you know, like gaming out. That's, he's saying reshaping. Do you buy that?
Well, I do. It's a potential. We're still in just a little past the first decade of these worlds. For one thing, people are getting used to the new technology in both World of Warcraft and Lord of the Rings. There are very excellent systems for assembling groups to do short-term or long-term tasks. And I believe we'll be using that kind of groupware in our ordinary lives more and more in the coming years. There are many aspects of World of Warcraft that are deeply embedded in Western culture and thus reinterpreting it. Why do people read books? I just published one. I hope they'll continue to. But why is everything linear? When I was a kid, my favorite novels were the 10 Mars novels by Edgar Rice Burroughs. Mm-hmm. One of them, the 1922 book Chessmen of Mars, actually includes a game that is a precursor to World of Warcraft. But why read novels rather than experience them in real time with other people where, yes, you're in a mythos and an aesthetic environment, but the outcome is partly determined by your own actions, not just by the author of the story.
So learn by immersion in this case.
And some freedom to shape the fate of the character that you identify with.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the sociology of virtual worlds and whether we might see our future in the massive multiplayer online game World of Warcraft. For one, William Sims Bainbridge is with us. Sociologist, has written the new book, The Warcraft Civilization, Social Science in a Virtual World. He logged over 2,300 hours playing 22 different characters in World of Warcraft. He's hardly alone in there. 11 million plus people pay a monthly subscription fee to join. I don't know if it's $10, $15, $20, something in there. In just a minute, we'll be joined by the editor-in-chief of WOW.com. It's a popular fan site for World of Warcraft. Elizabeth Harper will be with us. But first, let's turn to some of our listeners. Bill, if we may, here's a web comment from Linda. She says, I'm in a Warcraft guild in the game with several of my friends and chosen family. And it's a wonderful way to spend time together, even though we are separated by hundreds of miles. We laugh together and fight together and, yes, die together. And here's Joe in Alston, Massachusetts, on the air. Joe, you're on. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dr. Bainbridge, for being on. From 2008 to the end of 2009, I spent a year addicted to World of Warcraft. But I saw some amazing things in the Warcraft, and I wanted to ask Dr. Bainbridge his opinion. One thing I saw is a friend actually in my guild come from Europe and come and marry a guy in the guild in America. So they didn't have a wedding on the game, but they met through the game, through the guild, and actually got married. She came from Europe. The other thing I saw was two people, one restricted to a wheelchair, who used this game as an outlet, sort of like you would see on the movie Avatar. And the other person, she was basically a shut-in. Though she was a young girl, she had some kind of psychological issues, who was also in our guild, but used this as her means of communicating with friends. These were her friends. And from what she told us, she didn't go out in the real world because of agoraphobia or whatever it is that she had. And I found that amazing. I found that for them it was incredibly good. It was incredibly excellent outlet for them. For me, it was incredibly destructive. It caused me not to finish my Harvard thesis. I still haven't finished it. I was in depression after I finished because I wasted a year of my life. My girlfriend was about to leave me, and I finally quit when she joined a World of Warcraft online users group for women who are trying to get their men out of it. So for me, it was incredibly destructive. But for them, for some people, I can see it's quite good.
Wow, Joe, those are amazing stories, including your own. I mean, some empowering and sound good, and in your case, a tough story. But William Sims Bainbridge, what do you say to all those? A marriage made in this virtual world, more or less, wheelchair-bound, or an agoraphobe empowered by
World of Warcraft, and then, you know, Joe himself, who ran into some real destructive problems there.
Well, it's a world, and both good and bad things happen in worlds. It must be said of World of Warcraft that it is much more benign for families and for children than at least some of the competition, or indeed some other kinds of video and computer games.
Competition? You're saying it's better than what? Porn or heroin, or is that the better?
Well, another pretty good one that I respect quite a lot is the Scandinavian Age of Conan. But it has some content that's really not appropriate for small children, even though it's quite good in itself. Clearly, a number of kinds of games, not World of Warcraft, put so much emphasis on realistic violence that they would not be good for children.
Joe's talking about people with real-world handicaps who felt empowered, sort of Avatar style, in this game.
We use environments like this. People, including I myself, use Second Life for all kinds of business meetings. Young kids in World of Warcraft who otherwise don't interact much with adults get to learn how to cooperate as a part of a guild or parties going on quests together and so on. There's a long list of potential positives and negatives. I think the positives outweigh. But because it's a world, all kinds of things can happen in it.
Let's go to Robert in Seattle, Washington. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I want to say, I started playing World of Warcraft when it came out in 2004.
Yes.
I stopped playing about 2 years ago. When I started playing, I was, 22. I was young. I played, 24-hour marathons. Even
wow.
I would stay up at least for 2 days.
Wow.
When it just came out.
Yeah.
I was young. I didn't have any responsibilities. I didn't have a family. I had a job, which I lost because I was playing the game.
Oh boy.
Now I have a family. I have a son. I have a mortgage. I have a work. I have my work. I cannot play the game anymore. So I stopped. So the thing that I have an opinion on is to say that World of Warcraft is the future or the way the game is the future. You know, in World of Warcraft, you have to have 24 other people to get stuff done. In the real world, for me to get significant stuff done, I can do it by myself. That's pretty much my point.
Well, that's interesting. Less solidarity required in the real world than in Warcraft. William Sims Bainbridge, what do you say to Robert? And what about his woes? I mean, there's 4 years more or less he spent in there and finally had to bail out to, build his real world life.
People's lives vary. In fact, some of my characters got all the way in World of Warcraft without teaming up very much with others. It has a balance of solo and group. It's just that the group is very interesting. It, of course, presents only a range of possibilities about the future. If I may just mention
yes.
one example,
mm-hmm.
What is the future of the real space program? It is very seriously in doubt at the moment. It's been in doubt since the end of the Skylab program in February of 1974.
What do we learn from the game, then?
We know it's very much in doubt now. World of Warcraft, through some of the advanced quests and so on, suggests that the technology is not going to take us out into the universe. It's set on two other planets, but we get to them by magic. And the gnomes who are trying to build rockets and catapults keep failing. One of the most recent online worlds, Star Trek Online, is much more optimistic about real spaceflight. And yet it uses technology that's totally unrealistic. So you take the two together, and they raise very serious questions about one dimension of the future we've long assumed we would have.
I want to welcome into our conversation from Austin, Texas, Elizabeth Harper. She's editor-in-chief of WoW.com or WOW.com. It's a popular fan site for World of Warcraft news, analysis, and opinion, owned by AOL. She's also a producer for Massively.com, a site dedicated to massive multiplayer online games. Elizabeth Harper, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
It seems with 11 million people, you've got all kinds of things going on in World of Warcraft. Are you surprised to find a distinguished sociologist in there looking at human nature and maybe even the future through the lens of the game, Elizabeth?
I'm really not surprised because World of Warcraft takes all sorts. I mean, there are people who play it for 40 hours a week. There are people who play it for an hour a week. You have grandmothers, and you have school kids, and you have young and old, and you have everyone's in World of Warcraft right now. So it's a great mix.
You've played a character there, a blood elf paladin, whatever that is. I'm sure Warcraft players know exactly, but you've played it up to the sort of maximum level of the game. What have you learned about human nature or maybe about where we're headed as a offline civilization through the game, Elizabeth?
It's hard to say for human nature, but I went in originally playing because I had some friends. And the great thing about the game is you go in maybe to hang out or spend time with people you know, but you meet lots of people. And as you level up and you play together, you have your friends, you meet friends of friends, and then you meet friends of friends and friends, and you wind up with this incredible social circle in the game of people that you would never have interacted with otherwise. One of the members of my guild is a grandmother who plays, you know, in the evenings. And now we meet up once a year. Even though we don't all play together anymore, we try to meet up once a year at a convention in Atlanta. And it's just amazing, the range of people and the real human relationships you can make.
How big is a guild? Is it like a posse, a crew, a gang of friends? I mean, is this a dozen, a couple dozen, thousands? How big is a guild?
It can be, there's sort of a maximum size of a few hundred, but a guild can be any size, really. I mean, you could have a guild because players create guilds and manage them themselves.
And
so,
you fight together or live together or some combination?
It's really up to you. You can maybe you start your guild, you're all level one, and maybe you want to adventure together and level up together. Maybe you're a group of people who want to do dungeons, which you might need 5 or 10 people, or maybe you want to do raid dungeons, in which case you need 25 people.
And you talk to you communicate in text. You can actually use microphones and speak with one another as well.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to a call from Anna in Walpole, Massachusetts, if I may. Anna, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Wow.
My question was, how do you think that World of Warcraft will affect language, much in the way that Internet and all of its kind of, you know, well, Internet speak has even come into common use among young kids. People are even using it in papers. How do you think World of Warcraft will affect language, including things like common terms that are maybe in other languages? You know, I have friends that play in Australia, and they use different slang terms than I use. So how do you think World of Warcraft will eventually affect the language that everyone speaks?
Anna, we'll pick it up. May I just ask you, are there phrases or habits of speech that you've picked up or seen there that are distinctive to the game, to its realm?
Yeah, well, for example, because I am a player, I have some friends who will ask me, you know, oh, what kind of character do you play? I say, oh, my main tune is a level 80 Nelf Rogue, and they'll be like, what?
Okay,
so I got no idea what I'm talking about.
Right,
yeah.
Right, there's lingo right there. Let's listen to a little more of the language itself. Here's from Banshee's Revenge. It's a Warcraft quest released in the latest expansion in 08. Here's the opening dialogue between the Overthane Balargard and Varmadra, both servants of the evil Lich King.
You dare to challenge me? You haven't earned the right.
Wrong, Balargard. You will accept this challenge.
Varmadra? Did the Lich King send you personally? Very well. I will dispatch these creatures. It is only an inconvenience. Prepare to die! It's the Lich King!
Honor God, stay where you are.
They're from World of Warcraft. Bill Bainbridge, to our caller Anna's question, are we all going to talk like Wagnerian actors here, or is it lingo that might seep out into the offline world? What do you think of the language question?
Well, although World of Warcraft is international, millions of players in China and Europe, for example, precisely because it's so popular, it has nearly 500 different versions of itself optimized for different locales. And some of the less popular virtual worlds are much more multilingual. I've seen text in 12 different languages in Entropia Universe, for example, and Final Fantasy XI allows people whose native language is English, Chinese, and Japanese to use a kind of phrase book to work together. So I've seen more new language and polyglot stuff in other virtual worlds. In Second Life, I'll occasionally see someone type in a sentence in Portuguese. I assume they're Brazilian, actually. An automatic program does a rough translation into English, and then the Brazilian fine-tunes the translation in terms of their partial command. So I think virtual worlds in general will universalize human language to a significant extent, but World of Warcraft less so than some of the others.
Wow, there's a thought. Nashville, Tennessee, Pierre. Pierre, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm actually a graduate student studying human resource development, so that's probably going to kind of affect my perspective or my question, but I wonder what the sociologists' thoughts were about feedback, just, you know, maybe because there's so much feedback built in such a targeted kind of working towards goals in World of Warcraft, do you think that maybe people are feeling a lack of that, maybe in their personal lives or in the job setting that's kind of part of the draw?
That's a very interesting question. Bill Bainbridge, instant feedback and lots of it. You're in a million situations in a fairly condensed time. What about the impact of that?
Well, this could be quite significant. And part of it is earning somebody's trust and then trusting them in return because you're on a guild together. Incidentally, the largest guild that my level 80 blood elf Catullus has belonged to had over 4,000 members, and he was a guildmaster for a while himself, and one that had a couple hundred. But there's also an economic system where people learn about production and supply chains. They don't know the theory of it, but particularly if they're using the add-on auctioneer program that allows them to analyze prices, there's economic feedback there. It's also true that you can create things, some other virtual worlds like Second Life, it's a little, you have more capabilities. In some other than World of Warcraft, you can own a house. So there are lots of kinds of feedback, both from technical systems and from other people.
Elizabeth, what do you think? On balance, you know, do we've got grad students calling in here. Now, one who didn't finish his thesis because of it. But on balance, are people getting educated in World of Warcraft or dissipated?
I think there's a lot to learn if you want to learn it, because, for example, if you're doing a raid dungeon and you're trying to take out a dragon or a whatever, you have to be in a group of people and you have to work together. Someone has to understand what to do and tell other people what to do. You have to work as a team, and that's something that you don't necessarily get from classroom education. It's an interesting thing you can get from the game.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the sociology of virtual worlds and whether we might see our future in the massive multiplayer player online game World of Warcraft. 11 million or so people paying a monthly subscription of $15 to be in this world, and many are in this world a lot. William Sims Bainbridge is a sociologist. He spent 2,300 plus hours in Warcraft. He came out with a new book, The Warcraft Civilization, Social Science in a Virtual World. He joins us today from Washington. And from Austin, Texas, we're joined by Elizabeth Harper. She's editor-in-chief of WoW.com, W-O-W.com, a popular fan site for World of Warcraft news and analysis and opinion. And Bill, here's a web comment from David. He asks, what have you learned about the concept of collective intelligence and how it is evolving from your immersion and interactions in the World of Warcraft?
Well, collective intelligence can mean a lot of things. We've already talked about cooperation. One of the topics in World of Warcraft where we need more collective intelligence is degradation of the environment. And you and your quest partners in many areas of World of Warcraft encounter one or another kind of destruction of the environment, and then you need to make collective choices about how you're going to deal with that. In Zangarmarsh, for example, they're depleting the water resources. The plague lands have the terrible result of biological warfare. There's pollution in Feralis, Teldrassil, several other places. There is deforestation in the Stone Talon Mountains. And this provokes individuals, at least, to think about the issue about how we are going to be collectively more intelligent in dealing with our natural environment.
So here's a kind of culture of environmental awareness, possibly. Here's a comment and question from Tim. He says, I'm not a player, but an investor in World of Warcraft's parent company. One of the big markets to crack is China, but recently the Chinese government has banned World of Warcraft, apparently because it includes culturally insensitive characters such as skeletons. Is this really about culture, Tim asks, or getting a cut of the profits? Elizabeth, first to you, is it true that World of Warcraft is, or some version of it has been banned in China? And what do you know about the reason? Why?
I believe it was closed for a short period of time due to licensing issues of some sort. I know games have to be approved by the government before they can be released, and something went... I don't know the details about how it happened, but it was shut down for a period of time, and the government has not approved the release of the game's latest expansion, Wrath of the Lich King, in China. So there are certainly lots of gamers out there who are playing, but they are not playing the latest version in China unless they're playing it. I believe they can play on other servers in... Not in mainland China. Yeah.
Bill, how do you interpret China's reluctance with this latest version? Is this just a licensing thing, or is this a sensitivity to exactly what you're talking about, that cultures and values can get promoted here that may spill out of the virtual arena?
Well, it's very complex, and I'm very supportive of World of Warcraft's efforts in China. Bonnie Nardi, an anthropologist at University of California, Irvine, with graduate students, has compared World of Warcraft in China with the U.S., particularly how people in both countries write add-on programs to enhance the experience of World of Warcraft. It is true, of course, that the Chinese government is facing a major issue of will it transition to what we would recognize as more democratic forms. From this great distance, it doesn't appear that they are. And any kind of system that allows people to cooperate in China across cities to build communication links and so on, as we see with Google recently, could become the basis for criticism of the government, even opposition to it. In China, World of Warcraft is often played in group settings, and so the context is different. But they still play with people who are in other cities they wouldn't have met otherwise.
Here's a Facebook comment from Glenn. It says, remember, there are no really negative outcomes in Warcraft. They don't program it that way. This is a capitalist product. Results of research must bear this in mind. He says, yes, I played for years. I'll ask about that. Corey in Duxbury, Vermont. Corey, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I am not a player, but I hear this talk of raising environmental awareness for the game, and it just sounds self-indulgent to me because at the end of the day, it's a hypothetical, and the end result being more electronics consumed, more electricity being consumed. And I see a massive disconnect. And if there's such a great interest in doing something proactive, I think there's many different channels besides a hypothetical problem. The one we live in has many problems. Corey, I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, I hear you loud and clear. How about it, Bill? A kind of basic structural disconnector. You're learning about the environment, but sucking up electricity to do it.
Well, as a scientific researcher, I'm almost more interested in questions than answers, and this is a good one. On the other hand, I've been recently wondering whether a number of these worlds allow people to develop social status without the conspicuous consumption of large houses and physical travel to distant places. So while there's a little electricity and you got to have a computer, but you probably got one anyway, that you may have less need when I held the conference, when I hold committee meetings in Second Life. It cuts down on long-distance travel. It's not good for the airlines or the hotel industry, but it may be good for the environment.
Elizabeth, what do you think? Does status online transfer offline? Maybe you don't need a big house because you're a mugwump or something in World of Warcraft?
It certainly, yeah. The travel issue is certainly a thing. But then, on the other hand, I think a lot of people want to, if they've met and become friends, or they're dealing with each other in the virtual life, sometimes there's a desire to meet up in real life, in real life conferences or conventions.
Or real life marriage, as our caller Joe was telling us. Ryan in Salt Lake City, Utah. Ryan, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
My question is just that I have a younger brother who is 11, and I mean, he's kind of socially awkward. He doesn't have many friends, but he's extremely smart and loves computer and Nintendo games. And I think this would be great for him to help develop, you know, social skills and a network of, you know, friends. But what kind of maturity level and content should, I mean, is that okay for like an 11 and 12-year-old?
It's a good question. Elizabeth, what do you say to Ryan thinking of his brother?
Well, it's got the same problems as the real world, which is there are all sorts of people in it, and you'll find parents and things like that, and you'll find kids and teenagers and college kids who may not be talking in appropriate ways for a younger audience. It sort of depends on who you're spending time with in-game. And I think the message for parents is that, like with anything, you need to pay attention to what your kid is doing, even if they're in a video game. You kind of have to know what groups they're spending time with, because there's certainly a great chance for this to be a positive experience, a learning experience, but it just depends on what sort of crowd you're dealing with.
Wow, there's a world to crack in order to know. Bill, what do you think of throwing an 11-year-old into World of Warcraft? Would you do it with your own child?
Since I'm 69 years old, you better ask about my grandchildren.
Oh, grandchildren. Okay.
Elizabeth's point, very good. With all the other things, I mean, it's so much more benign in terms of the level of violence and gore than a lot of solo player electronic games. I find it more benign than many of the other virtual worlds or online experiences. As in one of your callers' messages earlier, a lot of people do it as families. Rather than being couch potatoes watching TV, they'll go questing together. And that can help an 11 or 12-year-old develop those positive social connections in World of Warcraft. Of all of these online environments, it's one of the most benign that I've seen.
Let's go to David in Acton, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I'm a psychologist. I specialize in computer addictions, treating mainly people who are compulsive pornographers or gamers.
Okay.
I really appreciate hearing Barry's description of the positive aspects of gaming, and it's good to hear that, and about group cooperation and how the technology is evolving. But clearly, every spring, there's an influx of emails from mothers. My 17-year-old son, you know, is playing World of Warcraft, used to be a great student. He's failing out of school. I've treated a lot of them. World of Warcraft is by far and above the most reported, you know, people coming and asking for help, with the most addictive you might say, if you want to call it an addiction, you can argue about terminology. The most compelling and by far has many people getting sucked in, like the previous two callers of yours, the one guy who spent four, mm-hmm. actually maybe 6 years mm-hmm. of his life lost in that till he got it back.
You say every spring. David, just as a minor point, but why in the spring do you get these calls?
Well, I think because they're coming up to graduation finally in the spring. My son's 17-year-old. He's not going to graduate.
I see.
He used to be a good student. Help me now.
And how do you account for how compelling or addictive it is? You must have dipped into it to figure that out.
I have. I've played the game myself, have a sense of how powerful it is. And there is a world there. And so how do we measure the negative impacts, the dangerous, the new pathological existences and realities in this new virtual world like it is? It's a whole world. And there's a whole area of study there as well that I'm interested what thoughts the sociologist Barry has on, you know, protecting, informing people. It's kind of an unknown. I think the power and danger of people's wasted years, of really bright young people's wasted years, is really underappreciated still. And the importance of getting the warnings out, and I agree, you know, keeping parents, you know, needing to supervise and watch what's going on so you know before they're
17. Yeah, we'll take it to Bill Bainbridge. David, stick with us for a second here. Bill, how do you respond? Here's a psychologist, you know, working with folks who are addicted or at least compelled to the point that it's painful, and wants to know your thoughts on them.
Well, first of all, it's a world, and we're beginning to get quite a number of researchers studying World of Warcraft or other things, and I gather he's familiar with it. Maybe he wants to do some research related to it.
It's a neighborhood, you might say, and there are neighborhoods you don't send your kids into without some pretty great care. You might not get into yourself without pretty great care. I guess David's looking at that downside situation.
Well, if I may talk about one of my kids, she was a little too old by the time World of Warcraft came out, but my daughter Wilma, who's just graduating in cognitive science from Yale, she learned how to read doing Nintendo games and did her first website at age 9, made money off it at age 11. At age 15, put up what's still there, the Center for Glitch Studies, where she and other people documented errors in popular games. I'm not saying that World of Warcraft or online environments in general can be a substitute for school. In her case, it dovetailed with what she was doing in school. I'm concerned not only about what draws kids in, but why the regular institutions of society aren't as satisfactory for many kids as they were for my daughter, who experienced the best of both worlds.
David, our psychologist caller, what do you think about that? Why is it more appealing than, you know, the world we walk in?
Well, you know, describing it as a world, it's a world, that puts it on a par with the world we all know. Mm. And it is very rich and can seduce one into feeling it has so many variations. You can be so many different ways in there.
Right.
And it can be like a real world. But the problem is it really a world or is it a game?
Well, I guess it's both in this era and the technology that we're with now. David, thanks for calling. Bill Bainbridge, do you come away optimistic about the human future, looking at the interactions you see in World of Warcraft, or something else?
Well, there is a basic humanity to it. It has a lot of good humor in it. It's not as grim as some of the others. But the core storyline is actually rather pessimistic. So I'm not sure. The fact that it is very solidly rooted in very well-developed past culture. I mean, in Stranglethorn Vale, you meet a character out of Joseph Conrad's great work, Heart of Darkness. And the fact that it encompasses so much of our culture and yet is new gives me a kind of cultural optimism that we've remained creative.
Elizabeth, has it made you a more optimistic person or given you a darker view?
I'm certainly optimistic because I see it as bringing people together and bringing together different types of people and different groups of people to accomplish goals and slay the dragon and work together and become friends with people you'd never know or meet otherwise.
Well, I have the strong feeling that this is far from the last conversation like this one we're going to hear as people move into these realms and spend more and more time, invest more of their minds and energies there. We're grateful to the two of you for taking us in today. Elizabeth Harper, editor-in-chief of WOW.com, joining us from Austin, Texas. Elizabeth, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
And William Sims Bainbridge, author of The Warcraft Civilization, Social Science in a Virtual World. Bill, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. And Loktar, which means victory in Orcish.
Loktar on in Orcish. We'll go out with Assault on New Avalon from World of Warcraft. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.